Ethan Devitt.
And I'm Tom Raber.
Welcome to this Alvine Talks podcast, in which we chat with allocators and thinkers across the world of investment and bring them some Alvine-level debate. We are joined today by Ian Prideaux, who until his retirement in 2022, headed the Grosvenor Investment Office in London for 16 years. Under his leadership, he embarked upon a bold vision of diversification into alternative assets. He was previously in charge of business development at HSBC Private Bank. Welcome, Ian. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you, Ian. We've known each other for quite some time, and we've enjoyed both a personal and a professional relationship. And both Ethan and I have been very inspired by how you have approached us and how kind and how professional you've been in every way that we had to deal with you. But we wanted to kind of go back in time and ask you a few questions about how you, if we call it, ended up in investments. Are you an accidental investor, or is this something that you always wanted to do?
I'm probably more of a sideways investor than an accidental investor. My career path sort of crabbed sideways towards running money. So I started as an accountant, then I became an investment banker, then I was a private banker, and then I joined Grosvenor as chief investment officer and actually started running some money. But throughout my career, I've been a keen personal investor, PA. So it was bringing, I think, all of those skills gained in those different jobs together that led me to, you know, end up where I did.
And, Ian, of course, we met when I was at Cambridge Associates and we worked with you at Grosvenor. I was particularly on the hedge fund side at that time. So making the move from the private bank into Grosvenor, how did that come up? And what was your kind of thought behind, do I take this on a single client as opposed to multiple clients?
It was largely fortuitous. I'd been at HSBC for 4 years, I think. There'd been a few changes inside the private bank at that time. And I suppose I had my eyes and ears open. And one of my colleagues at HSBC said, you might want to go and talk to Grosvenor. I think they're looking for somebody to run their family investment office. I went and had a chat, and that led to another chat and another chat. And I think after four interviews, they said, we'd like you to come and join us. And I said, yes. And I have to say, moving from the sell side to the buy side was a revelation and a switch that I very much enjoyed, as is evidenced by the fact I stayed there for the next 16 years. But I think from my point of view, and you referenced it there, Tom, having just one client, yes, I was working purely for the trustees of Grosvenor Estate Single Family Office. They were my client. It allowed me to develop the long-term persistent view of investment, as opposed to acting on the sell side, where clearly you have multiple clients. And yes, you want to do a good job for people, but you're very much tested on what you've sold yesterday, what you're selling today, and what you're going to sell tomorrow. It was a more short-term mindset.
And can I ask you, Ian, it's obviously a very prestigious role to work for the Duke of Westminster, a family that has 400-year history. Could you tell us a little bit of what that was like and maybe some anecdotes that were particularly noteworthy during your time there?
Yes. If I say it's a paternalistic organisation, that's meant in a very positive way rather than it being a sort of having old-fashioned connotations. I suppose, when do you measure a family's history from? All our families go back to prehistoric times. But the money, the wealth came into the Grosvenor estate sort of, 350 years ago, something like that. I used to joke to people that if you want to be seriously wealthy, just make sure you have an ancestor who marries the right woman 350 years in advance, because that's effectively what happened. Sir Thomas Grosvenor, as he then was, they weren't dukes in those days, married a lady called Mary Davis, after whom Davis Street is named. And Mary Davis's inheritance via an uncle was 100 acres of Mayfair and 200 acres of marshland outside London, which is an area we now call Belgravia. So that's not a bad inheritance to marry into. And in brief, keeping the story short, Mary Davis had been betrothed at birth to Lord Berkeley, as in Berkeley Square. But Berkeley didn't really have any land of any significance. And Mary's mother, who brokered the deal at Mary's birth, said to Berkeley, well, look, the deal is my daughter's got this 100 acres of Mayfair, the 200 acres of marshland. How about you put £5,000 into the combined pot when you get married, and we'll call that a deal? And she, Mary's mother, was going to take a little commission out of the £5,000. When it came to it, he couldn't come up with the money. He was a gambler. And the mother said, well, that's it. No money, no marriage. Somehow she gets introduced to Thomas Grosvenor, and the conversation went something like this. So my daughter's got 100 acres of Mayfair, the 200 acres of marshland. What have you got? Well, we've got a 11,000 acre estate just outside Chester. And Mary's mother's sort of eyes lit up and said, oh, 11,000 acres. Well, okay, it's a deal. And history has shown very clearly what became the most valuable landholding in the 350 years since.
Yeah, of course. I think you've really got the definition of a long-term investor with 350 years of investing. But going more into the specifics about your role, we obviously know the real estate angle to the Grosvenor estate, but then you came with your wisdom from the markets. Not only that, but you're interested in alternative investments. How was that when you introduced that at the family office?
Yeah, just to be clear here, real estate is the family business. It's not treated as such as an asset class. It could have been widgets or house building or something. It was real estate. So in running the family investment office, really my one constraint was no real estate. We'd got plenty of exposure there already and lots of people who knew a lot more about real estate than I did. So my task was to build out the other parts of the family office. And to no great surprise, it was the usual suspects. It was equities and bonds and cash. I introduced the alternative side, private equity, venture capital, private credit, everything that goes under the heading of private investments, hedge funds. We did do some commodities at one point. We looked at things like aircraft leasing, didn't do that, I'm glad to say. We looked at cat bonds. We didn't do those either. We did some infrastructure, which that got slightly close to real estate, but we concluded that it was far enough away that we weren't sort of double counting there. So really, it was building out a sort of an American university endowment type portfolio, save the real estate, and designed very much for the long term. And I was fully supported in that by the trustees. There was a sort of a nascent portfolio in place, which was largely equities, bonds, and cash that had been put in place by my predecessor. But my task was very much build this out into the sort of portfolio that we can live with for the next 50 years.
And of course, that period that you ran at 16 years, you would have seen a tremendous amount of evolution in some of these underlying asset classes. You were probably an early adopter in some of the hedge funds then and seen the evolution of that asset class. When you look back at, say, the portfolio, how it performed, any kind of highs and lows that you take from that, like any perhaps?
Quite a few of those. I joined in January 2006. So the returns we had from the hedge fund portfolio in 2006-07 were very good. I thought I'd really hit the nail on the head here, built us into a brand new asset class. And I think, Ethan, you'll remember the two of us going to New York to select the initial lineup, the initial portfolio. Well, of course, then 2008 came along and the whole marketplace looked a bit different. I'm sorry to say that hedge funds, to my mind, didn't quite cover themselves in glory in the 2008-09 downturn. They showed themselves to be every bit as susceptible as the long-only bit of the market. That said, my recollection is that in the calendar year 2008, we were down 9.9% across the entire portfolio, which, given the bloodbath in that year and the fact that a lot of long-only funds were down 20% plus, there were, I think, individual cases of people being down a lot more than that. To be down 9.9 wasn't that bad in the circumstances. But it certainly showed the benefit of having a diversified, well-thought-out portfolio. If I'd had a crystal ball, I'd have been in cash and gold throughout the that entire year. But we didn't come out of it too badly. One regret of mine was that I put up to the trustees in about Easter 2007 a proposal for a put spread sort of protection program. You have a program of rolling puts on S&P, FTSE 100, and essentially you pay your premium. That's your outlay. If everything continues to go up, the things expire worthless and you've lost your premium. It's a bit like saying, well, I paid for insurance cover on my house and it didn't burn down, so I wasted my premium. Unfortunately, after quite a bit of debate, they declined to go to back me on that one. But I do feel if we'd had that in place and we kept it rolling from 2007 into 2008, we'd have withstood the general financial crisis somewhat better. But that's the benefit of hindsight.
Well, it seems like for the most part, though, your investment committee bought into your ideas, and that must come down to how you presented them and how successful you were, I suppose. Could you elaborate on that, please?
Yes, I was reporting to a board of trustees. So that was six trustees, including the Duke. At the time, that was the sixth Duke of Westminster. They very much set the, or were interested in, the strategic part of the portfolio construction and build out. The tactical side, they were happy to leave to me with advice from Cambridge Associates and our independent committee member, Richard Nunnally. So if I went and said, we're going to take a couple of million off Schroders and give it to Jupiter out of this fund into that fund, that was fine. As one of the trustees memorably said to me, it's Michael McClintock, he said, look, our job isn't to second guess your tactical decisions. Our job is to make sure you haven't gone mad.
Yeah, so, well, that's very well.
They were very supportive of me in a tactical sense. Strategically, yes, they wanted to be involved. They were very happy to hear what I had to say to support my views in a case like the put spread strategy. It was one we debated fully, and at the end of it, they said, look, well argued, we understand where you're coming from. And I'm slightly putting words in their mouths now. It was almost a case of, you know, if we got a sudden downturn in the next year or so, this would pay off for us. But we're very much thinking long term. If you keep rolling these over and you keep losing the premium because the world doesn't end, then we've got a handbrake on. And we're happy to look that far ahead and say, let's dispense with the handbrake. Anyway. Nobody knew that 2008 was coming at that point.
But you survived.
Yeah, just asking about coming from that property lens. So you mentioned that's their business. And I suppose we can see it now. Here we are in 2024 with property undergoing another kind of moment of reckoning, perhaps in terms of valuations and question marks regarding offices, etc. Do you think that experience gave the owners any different tolerance for volatility? Tom already mentioned the very long-term approach. How did that lens inform how they looked at the rest of the portfolio?
There was, and I can see this quite genuinely, high tolerance for volatility. We never looked at risk as volatility. Risk was the risk of permanent loss of capital. Risk was being a false seller at the wrong time. You needed the liquidity, you had to get it somewhere, and you had to sell an asset you didn't want to sell. That was what we avoided at all costs. So, part of my role at Grosvenor in running the investment portfolio was to diversify, certainly, so we didn't have all the eggs in one basket with the property side, but it was to provide a pool of liquidity so that if anything bad happened on the real estate side, we could turn, or the trustees could turn to that pot, liquidate equities, bonds, cash holdings, near cash. I reckoned, I worked out that I could liquidate 70% of the portfolio within 2 weeks. So if a hole ever needed to be filled on the real estate side, that was where they would come. I'm glad to say that even in the financial crisis, even in COVID, even in bad years like 2018, the calls on my portfolio capital were very slight indeed. It's Grosvenor's a cautious, prudent organization. So we withstood a 2008 without any fire sales, without anybody coming to me saying, we need a large amount of money in a very short amount of time to fill some holes on the real estate side.
Do you feel that being a risk manager is something that resonates with you particularly well because of what you do in your private life? I'm particularly thinking of you as a downhill racer when you go at very, very high speed and up comes a sharp corner and it's a lot of ice. And some people might just say, okay, I'm not going to make it. Whereas you just got to hold on and really make sure you get through that corner. Is there a parallel there? I mean, for those of you, you can't see Ian, but he has a cast on his arm. He's just fallen off his bicycle or his hand. So he is a risk taker, but you seem to mitigate the risks quite well.
It's a matter of knowing what the risks are and preparing for them. So I'm not claiming that I've never fallen in a downhill, because I most certainly have. But I've always carefully inspected the course beforehand. I know what's coming up and what sort of speed I should be able to take things at. That said, I'm probably a little more risk tolerant in my private life than I ever was in my professional life.
Looking back now, Ian, and maybe you can talk about who you handed the office over to and what you're pursuing now in this post-Grosvenor era. But before that, when you look back, would you say, okay, that's an investment I would never do again? That's an investment that I'm so glad I did. When you go looking back at kind of the story of that portfolio over 16 years, what really stands out as something you're glad that your name is attached to?
Well, the asset class I'm most proud of is the private investment side, principally private equity. And within that, I include secondaries, growth capital, venture. So private equity in its widest context. That was a program that I got going when I joined in 2006. When I left in April 2022 to hand over to my successor, we were netting an IRR of just over 16%, which I was pretty proud of. Obviously, you can always pick out individual funds, individual managers you'd rather you didn't, you haven't had. Absolutely nobody can say they picked the best investments throughout the entire piece. So I'm not going to name names there. But suffice to say, on the private side, there were only two. Well, there was one small investment where we'd been in some time and we were sort of below the line on, but it really was quite a small investment. It was one of the earliest ones we made. And I think there were a couple of others that were still going through the J curve when I left, which on paper were in negative territory. But on the whole, on the private side, even the bad performers made us money, not as much as we'd have liked, but we were keeping up with inflation. So pretty happy there. On the hedge fund side, that was an asset class that transformed quite a lot. In 2006, we were doing a lot of long-short equity, a bit of merger arb, not very much, a fair bit of macro. And life looked pretty good for a couple of years till the GFC came along. And then we saw which hedge funds were actually hedged. And a sort of distressing number were not very well hedged at all. If I wind that one forward to 2022, when I left, we'd taken the hedge fund allocation down a fair bit. It was still there, but it was a smaller part of the portfolio than it had been. We were netting just over 5%. We'd set ourselves a target of short-term T-bills, three-month T-bills, plus 4%. Now, given that interest rates for a large part of that period were pretty close to zero, or, you know, the square root of not very much, then that figure plus 4% got you to somewhere around 5. And we did a bit better than 5. So we could say that we'd achieved our goal, achieved our benchmark, but a 5% CAGR was nothing very much to be writing home about. So I fear the hedge fund world changed quite a lot in my time there. It became more crowded. There were more people in the same trades as each other. There were a fair few long-only managers who decided that they could make a bit more money in terms of fees by running a hedged portfolio. Global macro was a very, very difficult one to get right indeed. And I don't think we had anybody who was consistently good on global macro. So it became another asset class that a lot of managers got into. There were a lot that weren't very good at it. There were an awful lot that were right in the middle of the pack. They weren't dreadful, but they weren't delivering the sort of returns that we'd hoped for from a hedge fund portfolio. So not a disaster at all, but not quite the elixir we'd hoped they would be.
No. Can I ask, Ian, having been at Grosvenor for 16 years, how do you feel now being away from that and they turning the page and now it's a new chapter in your life? And what are you planning to do?
Well, number one, I miss it, but it was time to move on. I had a very, very able number two there who's now taken over my job in substance, Henrietta Gourlay. I very much wanted to give her her chance to spread her wings. I am now doing a dreadful term, but I think I've gone plural. I have a couple of consultancy roles. I sit on the investment committee of another family office. This is a first-generation family office, a gentleman called Steve Edwards, who made his money in the dot-com boom selling a business. It was in sort of mobile phone billing to an American conglomerate back in 2000, 2001. He made himself quite a lot of money. I sit on his investment committee, funnily enough, with a couple of former colleagues of EFIN's from Cambridge Associates. I work with a business in Luxembourg that helps family offices with their investments in private equity, but more on the direct equity side than funds. And I'm very much, my job there is to be sort of Mr. UK and make some introductions in this country. And then I have a couple of pro bono roles. One is with a part of the British Library that has a modest investment portfolio that I look after, and the Hampshire and Isle of Wight Community Foundation, which is a grant-making body and that sort of distributes benefactor money and some government money to worthy causes, specifically in Hampshire and the Isle of Wight, the Isle of Wight being an island that I have some connection to because I go there to sail in the summer. So that's my
Well, how wonderful. I mean, you seem to be busier now than you've ever been, and that's wonderful to hear. I mean, looking specifically at the world of investments, what do you think the world of investment will look like in 10 years' time? I appreciate that's a very broad question.
Yeah. Well, I don't think there's anything very new under the sun. I suppose AI is the big topic du jour. I can foresee more money being run by machine than is the case at the moment. I don't think we'll ever get to a point where machines run the whole thing, but sort of who knows? I think you've still got to have somebody setting the overall parameters, the overall constraints, but the chances are we'll see more money being passively run. It is an interesting philosophical question as to how much money can be run passively before the market collapses. At the moment, I believe in the US, it's something like 50% of all money is run passively. You get to a ludicrous absolute position. Could you have 90% of all money being run passively? There's surely a sort of reductio ad absurdum where the few remaining active managers effectively pull all the strings in the market, because if they can just force a given company into or out of an index and know that all the trackers have got to follow them in or got to follow them out, you would have a very, very imperfect market. So I think there are limits there. But even if passive money in the market was limited to, let's say, 60% or two-thirds, you're still going to have active managers to decide where the market's actually going. It can't be left entirely to the passive side. And those active managers may well be making a lot of use of artificial intelligence to give themselves steers in the market or to pick up forward indicators that nobody else has got or that they think nobody else has got, which I suppose is always the holy grail. Tell me what is going to be in tomorrow's papers. Tell me what tomorrow's share prices are going to be. I'm sure active managers will be making as much use of those sources of help, sources of assistance as they can. But the underlying asset classes, I don't think are going to change very much at all.
And moving to some reflections now. So we've 16-year career at Grosvenor, long career in private markets before then. When you look back at the people that have influenced you over that time, anyone that you can mention who maybe left an impression on you from the industry?
It wasn't so much an individual as an institution, and that institution was S.G. Warburg & Co., which those of your subscribers to this podcast with slightly longer memories or have been in the market slightly longer will know well. It was the preeminent UK merchant bank. And after, well, I suppose Morgan Grenfell gave them a run for their money, they sold out to Deutsche Bank. Warburg was the leading independent quoted UK investment bank. And it was a remarkable place. It really banged home the importance of doing your research, writing it up well, getting it checked, presenting it well. Almost the greatest sin that you could commit was to put a typo into a document or to present something that hadn't been checked by an independent party. It was an amazing education, and it taught real attention to detail and discipline. And the alumni of that bank, and I'm one of them, meet up every year just for a Christmas lunch, and we still get a very, very good turnout. So in terms of preparing one for the world of work in the city, it was, I think, unparalleled. So there were lots of individual people there who were pretty remarkable people, but I'm not going to pick any of them out individually, just to say collectively, it was a remarkable institution and one that, by and large, didn't. Maybe things changed a bit when it fell into the arms of UBS. It didn't reward the star culture. It was very, very much a collegiate culture.
You've got two sons, Ian. Are they going to be coming into the investment business?
I don't think so. My elder son is at PA Consulting. He's been there for 3 years, management consultancy. He sort of majors on the defense side. That's very much his personal interest. He's quite keen at investing sort of PA for himself. So I do get asked for a bit of advice from time to time, but I don't see him moving into investment management. And my younger son, Charles, is still going through the interview rounds with various graduate trainee positions. And, you know, fingers crossed, he'll nail something down soon. Both of them, so with my help, did some internships in investment management of one sort or another, but don't think either of them is going to be making their career there.
Right. Well, thank you. Now, moving on to reflections on your life and what you've achieved and looking back, what advice would you have for your younger self?
I thought quite hard about that one. I think the saying I most like and would recommend that anybody starting out their career thinks about is, if you enjoy your job, you'll never work a day in your life. In other words, if you enjoy what you're doing, it's not a chore. You like doing it. You want to go to work and get on with it. I think there's an awful lot of people who slog through a career that isn't really for them. It provides an income, but they're not particularly interested. And I'm sure there are some people who actually hate what they're doing, but they go on doing it. So think very carefully at the outset. What is it I really enjoy doing? If you're a medic and you really enjoy what you're doing, basically making people better, and you get off on that, then be a medic. Same thing with lawyers. But think very hard about what it is that, you know, really floats your boat or lights your fire, and then make your way towards it. And I did think from quite early on in my career, and I applied for a few jobs, yeah, investment management sounds really interesting to me. But I sort of crabbed sideways. I got there in the end. But if I could wind the clock back, I think I'd have gone into that part of the financial world a bit earlier on.
Well, thank you, Ian. I pass over to Ethan.
Yes, okay. Thank you, Ian. It's been such a pleasure to know you over the years from your time working at Grosvenor. One of the elements you brought to working together and then just being colleagues in the industry has been an endless curiosity and deep sense of fun and enjoyment. There's always a sense that you've been not only engaged by the investments that you've looked at, but you've also really seen the human side and always derived a lot of enjoyment from it. So thank you so much for bringing that sense of fun to the industry and for sharing your insights here with us.
No, thank you. Thank you for saying that, Ethan. And yes, you're right. That's one of the real buzzes that I got out of my job, was that I had the opportunity to interact with some very, very clever people in a wide range of industries. So on the private equity side, the people there were very good at structuring deals, but they knew a lot about a lot of industries that was interesting. Similarly with the hedge fund managers, maybe they didn't always make the right calls, but they certainly did the research. The good ones anyway knew exactly what they were getting into. The ability to have those sorts of conversations, and indeed with advisors such as Cambridge Associates, who obviously were dealing with a very wide range of clients, it was an atmosphere that just got me buzzing and it got me excited, and I like dealing with the people.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. Also, we mustn't forget the times we've had wine tastings together, and your knowledge, of course, there is very deep, almost as deep as it is when it comes to investing, and we've been able to host them at your office as well. So on behalf of everyone, thank you very much indeed. And Ian, thank you for taking the time to be on Alvine Talks this afternoon. Thank you.
No, delighted. And Ethan, thank you very much. Tom, thank you very much. Good to see you both.
So Tom, how did you enjoy catching up with Ian then in his post-Grosvenor existence?
I think it was great. I think Ian has always been a very colourful person in Mayfair in the investment circles. But most importantly, he's been, as you alluded to many times, a very open and a great person to have to deal with, both professionally and personally. And we've shared some interests over the years. But he's always been open to a dialogue, even when we've both worked for smaller firms and the Grosvenor Estate probably didn't need to talk to us, but he always did. And I appreciated that from him. But he's also, most importantly, of course, from an investment point of view, he has a very strong investment sense of risk reward, what may work, what may not work. And I think we didn't talk too much about it, but you know, I think what some people develop over the years is basically a feeling for what may or may not work. In Germany, they call it the Fingerspitzengefühl. And certainly Ian has that in spades.
Absolutely. And I think what I said about his clear, evident enjoyment in the area made working with him such a pleasure. And I think that openness to admitting mistakes and to having that ultimate long-term view, it's often clients will say they have a long-term investment horizon, but they say and do may often be contradictory, but he genuinely did have that horizon. So it was great to catch up with him and see that he's still going strong.
No, he is. And he's missed at Grosvenor, but as he said, he does a lot of other things in the investment business. And no surprise, lots of people have engaged him for his knowledge and his wisdom. And that's, completely understandable. And he's a first-class guy. It was a real pleasure to have him on the podcast.
I'm Ethan Devitt.
And I'm Tom Raber.
Thank you for listening to the Alvine Talks podcast. If you liked what you heard and would like to tune in to hear from more inspiring investors, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, and all views are personal and should not be attributed to the organizations and affiliations of the host or any guest.